Good morning, YouTube. Professor Jiang here with another video. Now, some of you in the comment section have been asking me why World War III has not started, why the conflict between the United States and Iran has abated. The answer is because modern warfare is hybrid warfare. 90% of warfare you will not see. So much of warfare nowadays is informational, controlling the media narrative, electronic, cyber warfare, psychological, weakening the will of the people to fight you, and covert ops, economic sabotage, imposing sanctions, trying to assassinate the leaders of Iran. So the United States and Israel are committed to a policy of regime change in Iran. Ideally, they would like to assassinate the Ayatollah Khamenei because that would trigger a secession crisis in Iran. Right now, their main strategy is to decrease the legitimacy of the regime in Iran. And the best way to do that is to decrease the capacity of the state to deliver basic services. For example, water. So what's happening in Tehran right now, a city of 10 million, is there's a water shortage. Because of heat, because of economic sanctions, because of overpopulation, Tehran is having problems ensuring water supply to its people. You can bet good money that the Israelis and Americans will take advantage of that to engage in economic sabotage, basically trying to destroy as much of Iran's critical water infrastructure as possible. They would want to basically create a famine, a drought. Now, the irony of that is that by engaging in this economic sabotage, the Iranian people will develop a greater resolve to resist. And once the resolve, once the will to fight has been increased to a certain level, then the Iranian government can close off the Strait of Hormuz, which would compel an American ground invasion. And if America were to do that, America were to send in ground troops. And as I've said in multiple videos before, the American military would lose this war. Okay, so that's how I see the war developing over the next few months. Today, I want to talk about what the future is going to look like next 10, 20 years. I want to take everything we've learned so far and combine it into a grand thesis about how the world will develop. And the argument I want to make to you today is that eschatology drives geopolitics. And to make this argument, I'm going to ask three questions. First question is, why are eschatologies so compelling? Second question is, what are the major eschatological traditions and how do they converge together? And the third question is, based on these convergence points, what can we predict about the future? All right, so let's look at the first question, which is, why are eschatologies so compelling? And as I've said before, eschatologies are compelling because they are narratives that capture the human imagination. They answer three fundamental questions. Where do we come from? What are we doing here? Where are we going? It's a complete story on to itself. You can think of eschatologies as scripts, really. Scripts that have a momentum of their own. Scripts that allow for unconscious coordination. Scripts that present roles for individuals to audition for. So, just by participating in a script, you are helping the eschatology progress forward. Okay? And to understand why eschatologies are so powerful, please remember the universal law of game theory. In a previous video, I discussed how people win in the game. And the formula that tells us who wins a game is mass times energy times coordination. As I also said in that video, conspiracies there are plenty of conspiracies, but they're not that effective. Because it's very hard to maintain secrecy. You can't maintain plausible deniability. And because everyone has an ego, it's hard to maintain cooperation because everyone's fighting for his or her best self-interest. But with an unconscious coordination, which is what an eschatology provides, that allows for secrecy, plausible deniability, and frictionless cooperation. And that's why eschatologists are so powerful. Now, some of you may hear this and think this doesn't make any sense because it's really individual self-interest that motivates us. And what's really important to understand is these things, eschatologies and individual self-interest, are not in conflict with each other. In fact, they reinforce each other. Now, in school, you may be taught that to succeed in life, you have to work hard, you have to be talented, you have to get good grades in school, and you have to be very intelligent. Certainly, that's what I believed. And it took me 20, 30 years to recognize I was wrong. It's not what you know, it's who you know. To succeed in life, you have to be able to work with others in a secretive, unconscious, coordinated manner in order to achieve certain goals. And that's what eschatology provides. So when you subscribe to an eschatology, when you commit to an eschatology, others will help you achieve wealth and power. Okay, so that's why eschatologies are so compelling and so powerful. Not only do they capture our imagination and inspire us to collective action and sacrifice, they also benefit us materially. Okay, so now let's move on to second question, which is, what are the major eschatological traditions out there and how do they converge? So before I go into the six major traditions, I want to remind everyone of three caveats. The first caveat is that within each religion, the eschatology is only a minority extreme view, okay? Only a small minority of religious devotees will actually believe in the eschatology. That's the first caveat. The second caveat is that there's tremendous diversity within each eschatology. You can interpret the eschatology allegorically, which is to say that it's compelling you to a path of personal redemption and salvation in order to improve the world, or you can interpret it literally, which is that this is a true prophecy and everything in it will happen in order for the world to end or for the world to become a better place. Okay? And also, there are different sequencing of events and different interpretations in the eschatology. Okay? So that's the second caveat. Eschatologies within each tradition are very diverse. And the third caveat is that eschatologies are dynamic. And the reason why is eschatologies are in conflict, are in competition, in communication with different eschatologies. Think of eschatologies as stories that are trying to be the best possible story in order to capture the imagination of their believers. And to do that, they're going to incorporate the best elements from different eschatologies into their own. And that's why so many of these eschatologies, they follow a similar pattern because they've been learning and adapting from each other. Okay, so having said these three caveats, let's go into the six major eschatological traditions. And I'm going to focus on the most extreme version of each tradition because according to game theory, it's the fanatics who matter. It's the fanatics who are the most energetic, who are the most committed to achieving the eschatology. So the first eschatology is Zoroastrianism, which was the original eschatology. In the Zoroastrian tradition, the world is divided into good and evil, the light and the darkness, the truth and the lie. And at the end of the days, there'll be a final battle between these two cosmic forces. And as humans, we must choose which side to fight for. At the end of this battle, when good has triumphed, there'll be a day of judgment. Okay? And this structure, this cosmology, heavily influenced Judaism. And so in the Judaic tradition, because Jews have been persecuted for thousands of years, they believe that eventually a Messiah of war will come to them, and he will lead the Jews to victory against all the enemies. He will reconstitute the nation of Israel and bring back all the Jews from the diaspora. He will build the third temple, and he will usher in the Messianic age of peace, prosperity, truth, justice. Okay, that's the Judaic tradition. The Judaic tradition went on to influence the Christian Zionist or the Protestant tradition. Okay, so the Protestants believe that the Messiah is Jesus, and he's already come. So in order to usher in his second coming, certain conditions have to be met. First condition is the nation of Israel has to be reconstituted, and it was in 1948. Then the third temple has to be built, and there has to be a war of Gog and Magog. The Antichrist has to appear. And once these conditions are met, then to save his people, Jesus will descend from heaven on a cloud, destroy all his enemies, and usher in a millennium of peace, truth, and justice before the final judgment. When Jesus returns, there will be a rapture where all Christians will immediately ascend to heaven. So that's the Christian Zionist Protestant tradition. And again, this is the most extreme form of that tradition. Then you have the Islamic tradition, which is based both on the Judaic and the Christian tradition. And it's very similar. So the Muslims believe that after an age of tribulation, when the world has turned its back on God, when the world is divided, a great leader will come to unify the people and lead the people to victory in the war of Gog and Magog. Gog and Magog is interpreted as the Antichrist, and Gog and Magog can be interpreted as maybe Western civilization for its materialism, but it could also be a certain force. So, for example, maybe the city of London. So that's the Islamic tradition. Then you have the Orthodox tradition, which is what we talked about in the last video. The Orthodox tradition believes that Moscow is the third Rome and has a destiny to restore the Byzantine Empire. And to achieve this destiny, Moscow will fight a war with Turkey. It will destroy Turkey and then return the Greeks to Constantinople, thus restoring the Byzantine Empire and thus unifying the Orthodox Christian world. Now, what's really interesting is that there is a geopolitical theorist named Alexander Dugin who's turned this eschatology into a master plan for Vladimir Putin to implement. If you don't know who Alexander Dugin is, you have to watch his interviews, you have to read his books, because he's probably the most important geostrategic thinker we have today. I'm going to put his videos and his books in the description below, so please make sure you spend the time to actually research him, because so much of what he says helps us understand the world as it is today and how the world would develop over time. So in 1997, Dugin published a book called Foundations of Geopolitics, where he describes this master plan for how Moscow can restore the Byzantine Empire. So what he understands is that for the longest time, whoever controls the seas controls the world, because most trade was done through sea. But in a time of nation states, in a time of railways, if one power can unite the Europe and Asian continents into the Eurasian continent, then that power can negate sea power and become the global hegemon. And that's why the British the British Empire are committed to two things. The first thing they're committed to is maintaining naval power. The second thing they're committed to is ensuring that no major power would arise in the Eurasian heartland. And that's why the British basically provoked Germany into World War I, because Germany was threatening to be this power. And that's why Britain is now afraid of Russia, because Russia is trying to be that power to unify the entire Eurasian heartland. For Dugin, to unify the Eurasian heartland, what Moscow needs to do is, first of all, create the Berlin-Moscow axis to reconcile itself with Europe. It must also create the Moscow-Tokyo axis to reach out to Southeast Asia, and also to create the Moscow-Terrain axis to control the resources of the Middle East. And by building this alliance, what Moscow is doing is not only restoring the Byzantine Empire, but it's also restoring the Pax Mongolica, the Mongol Empire. So Moscow sees itself as the heirs to both the Byzantine Empire as well as the Mongolian Empire. Now, Dugin thinks this is entirely possible because the Iranians, the Japanese, and the Germans all feel slighted, humiliated by the Anglo-American Empire. So if you give them a choice between sticking with the Anglo-American Empire or joining the new Russian Confederation, where they'll be giving more freedom, then they will opt for the Russian Confederation. So that's the grand plan. Now, obviously, the Anglo-American Empire is going to oppose this plan. And so for Dugin, what's important is to create internal chaos and dissent and conflict within America and within Britain to destroy the Anglo-American Empire. And that's already happening right now, because you have Brexit in Britain, and now you have this mass immigration, which is threatening the British identity. In America, you have Donald Trump, who is proposing America First. So all is going to plan. This plan also recognizes that both Turkey and China are also enemies to the rise of this Eurasian unification. But as we discussed in the previous video, Turkey itself is not very stable. It's kept together for the political maneuvering of Erdogan. Once he's gone, then all these ethnic tensions, these geopolitical tensions, these economic tensions that exist in Turkey will explode, and it will overwhelm Turkey, thus causing it to collapse as a nation state. It will lose its coherence as a nation state. Dugin is not worried about China as well. He understands that Russia and China can never be allies because China is too economically dependent on the Anglo-American Empire. Basically, the point is Russia has nothing to offer China. China, it's basically a manufacturing economy which must sell its goods to the Anglo-American Empire. Russia cannot absorb these goods. At the same time, there are a lot of internal contradictions in China. I can tell you, as someone who lives in China for many, many decades, China is not going to survive an economic catastrophe. It's not going to survive an ecological catastrophe. In fact, its economy is propelling the nation to an ecological catastrophe. China is overpopulated, has very little resources, and it imports one-third of its food. It imports most of its oil. These vaunted industries, EV, AI, rare minerals, they're all contributing to massive ecological destruction in China. I mean, you can say it's unsustainable, but you can also say these economic policies that destroy the environment, it's really suicidal, okay? So China does not have a very bright future ahead of it. So Dugin's not worried about China either, okay? So that is the master plan of Alexander Dugin. And again, it is based on the Orthodox eschatology, which perceives Moscow as a third Rome and perceive Vladimir Putin as a last czar, as this great unifier of the world. In Dugin's terms, Putin is the katakon. Okay, the katakon is a Greek word meaning the force that restrains the Antichrist. Okay, so for Dugin, Moscow has responsibility to be the force for civilization, for good, for God. Okay, now let's move on to the last eschatological tradition, which is the Catholic eschatology. Now, it's interesting because if you read Augustine and the City of God, what he argues is that the church is the millennium. The church is the embodiment of the Messianic age. So with the coming of the church, the world has ended because the church is able to step out of history and ensure peace, truth, and justice in the world. And that very much is still the official Catholic Church line. There are eschatological elements to the Catholic Church. For example, Catholics do believe that there'll be a second coming of Jesus, and there'll be some certain signs that precede the coming of the second coming of Jesus, which include the mass conversion of Jews, which include the age of tribulation, which include the coming of the Antichrist. But for the most part, the Catholic Church is committed to a policy of personal eschatology, which argues that it is for our own personal transformation, our own personal salvation and redemption through the guidance of the church that allows for a better world. This is the official line, but we can be suspicious that this is actually what they really believe. I'm sure that there are certain elements within the Catholic Church who do have an eschatological worldview, okay? And there are three reasons why I would think the church, many elements in the church, want radical global transformation, okay? So let's look at these three reasons. First of all, we have to remember the origins of the Catholic Church. It started out as a secret conspiracy against the Roman Empire, and it succeeded, okay? So the Catholic Church is very good at conspiracies. In fact, it really developed the world's first intelligence agency, first global intelligence agency. There are certain elements within the Catholic Church, the Jesuits, Opus Dei, which are famous for their effectiveness, their organization, their strategy. Okay, so that's the first thing we have to remember about the Catholic Church. They are very good at conspiracies. In fact, they're so good, we don't even talk about their conspiracies. So if you go online on Twitter, on social media, everyone's talking about the deep state. Everyone's talking about the Jews. Everyone's talking about the City of London. But no one's talking about the Catholic Church. That's really weird. You have books and books and books of how Jews have influenced history, but very few books on how the Catholic Church influenced history. I would think that the most powerful, wealthiest, and most secretive organization in human history for the past 2,000 years, they would have a much greater impact on human history than the Jews. Okay, so the second thing to remember about the Catholic Church is before the Anglo-American Empire, they were the empire. Okay, they had 1,000 years from the fall of Rome until the rise of the British Empire when they were in charge, when they were the de facto power in the world. And for many, they believe that was the Messianic age, that was the millennium, that was the most perfect age, the most golden age in human history. And we screwed it up. We threw it away with the rise of the British Empire, and therefore we must return to that golden age when the Catholic Church was the dominant empire in the world. And the Third thing to remember about the Catholic Church is they really are the most powerful non-state organization in the whole world. They have a global network. They have 1 billion followers. If there is a global catastrophe, they are the most ready to rebuild the world after it collapses. So these are major advantages for the Catholic Church. And that's why I think that there are many elements within the Catholic Church who do have an eschatological worldview. They have a plan to conquer the world, and they are slowly implemented. Okay? So having said that, let's go over the major opposition, the opponents of the Catholic Church. Well, the first major opponent, of course, is the Anglo-American Empire. And the Anglo-American Empire represents, of course, Enlightenment principles, neoliberalism, materialism, capitalism, Protestantism. Okay, and remember, the Protestants and Catholics hate each other. These are the two greatest rivals in human history. Their wars have cost millions of lives. Okay, so that's the first major opponent to the Catholic Empire that the Catholic Church must destroy. Okay, the Anglo-American Empire. Second opponent is the nation state. So in Augustine's formulation, the church is outside of history. It is above history. It controls history. But with the French Revolution, the idea of a nation state came into being. And the idea of a nation state is that it is above church. Okay, and that's why in France, there's such an emphasis on the separation of church and state. So obviously, the Catholic Church wants to reverse this order. And in order to reverse this order, it really has to destroy the concept of the nation state. Okay, and the third major opponent is really modernity itself, the cult of the individual, which celebrates materialism, hedonism, pleasure, multiculturalism. Okay, so the church needs to destroy all three forces if it is to resume the millennium. And we can suspect that there's already a plan in place. And the Catholic Church stands a very good chance of achieving its eschatology. So let's look at the three signs that the Catholic Church has a plan in motion. Well, the current Vice President of the United States, J.D. Vance, he is a recent Catholic convert. The new Pope is an American. Okay, I don't think these are coincidences. I think this is all part of a larger plan. We also have to remember that the Catholic Church is embedded into the institution of power in the United States. So 6 of the 9 Supreme Court justices are Catholic. Okay. Also, the CIA was founded with the help of the Vatican. So William Donovan, who was the founder of the OSS, the precursor to the CIA, he was a Catholic who was very good friends with the Pope. Also, when the CIA came into being, it had a mandate to fight communism around the world. The problem was that at that time, the CIA didn't have a global network. The Vatican did have a global intelligence network. And so the CIA and the Vatican formed a holy alliance against communism. And there have been so many CIA directors who are Catholic that the CIA has been nicknamed Catholics in Action or the Catholic Intelligence Agency. Okay, so the Vatican and the CIA are very, very close. Another sign is that the Catholic religion is growing very, very fast in America. Right now, it's about 22% of the American population, but all those immigrants that are coming to America, half of them are Catholic. And these are the legal immigrants. We're not counting the illegal immigrants who are majority Catholic. And also, remember, Catholics have more children than Protestant families. So the demographic trend looks very good for the Catholic faith. But we can also argue that if there's an American Civil War, a second Civil War, and the institutions of authority are destroyed, the American Catholics are in the best position to capture the American state. And if they're able to capture the American state, then they would control the world. Okay, so I think there are some fanatics within the Catholic Church who want to initiate a second American Civil War because they believe that this war will create the opportunity for the Catholic Church to control America and thus destroy all three of its major opponents, the Anglo-American Empire, the nation state, and modernity itself. Okay, so having looked at the major eschatological traditions, I'm going to discuss where they converge. And what's really interesting is there's actually quite a few convergence points that are very important. The first convergence point is that there'll be a major conflict in the Middle East that will suck in the whole world. It'll be World War III, okay? Second convergence point is that America will not be involved in this war. And that's very interesting because America is right now the global hegemon. So why America isn't involved in this war, we don't know. It could be because they launched a ground invasion of Iran, it failed, and they were forced to retreat. It could be the civil war going on in America, okay? But America is not involved in this war. The third convergence point is that China is not involved in this war either. And I suspect that it's because China is facing an ecological catastrophe. It doesn't have enough water, it doesn't have enough food, it doesn't have enough resources for its people, and you have internal dissent throughout the nation. China is having a hard time keeping itself together. The fourth convergence point is that the Antichrist will emerge. And different traditions understand the Antichrist differently. But they all believe that this powerful force will emerge, who is charismatic and who will unify the world. Another convergence point is that Israel will become the dominant power in the Middle East, presumably after America leaves the Middle East. And we can understand why, because if America leaves the Middle East, then all of America's military infrastructure, CENTCOM, will merge with the Greater Israel Project, thus creating the Israel Empire. Another convergence point is that anti-Semitism will grow around the world, compelling Jews to return to Israel. Another convergence point is that the Dome of the Rock will be destroyed, and thus provoking the Muslim world to take arms against Israel and possibly initiating the War of Gog and Magog. Another convergence point is the Age of Tribulation, when the world will face economic, ecological, geopolitical catastrophe after catastrophe after catastrophe, when people's faith will be tested, when the Antichrist will emerge to deceive people into believing false prophecies, into believing magic, into believing superstitions, into denying the authority of God and of the church. Okay, so these are the major convergence points. So now let's go on to question number three. Based on these convergence points, what can we predict about the future? So based on all this, I'm going to paint you a picture of the future and what it looks like. And some of these will not work out, some of these will work out. But it's an interesting framework for us to think about how geopolitics might develop over the next 10 to 20 years. Okay, so the United States launched a ground invasion of Iran. Iran is supported heavily by Russia. The United States, after a few years of fighting, they give up and they retreat. And so the American Empire retreats back into the Western continent. But this triggers a civil war in America. In Ukraine, NATO decides Odessa will be the last stand. So Russia encircles Odessa and lays siege to it. All of NATO is brought in to defend Odessa. This is the very last stand. And France, Britain, Romania, Poland, All the NATO countries are brought in. Turkey is brought in as well. And it's a stalemate. This war is going nowhere. But the Europeans don't understand why they're fighting this war. The European people revolt. And this causes civil war in France, in Britain. It causes political upheaval in Germany. It causes a political revolution in Turkey. And after these civil wars and these revolutions, Europe becomes more pro-Russian, allowing for reconciliation between Putin and Europe. Turkey is destroyed in this process. Putin allows the Greeks to return to Constantinople, restoring the Byzantine Empire, and thus unifying the Orthodox world. After the United States leaves the Middle East, the Greater Israel Project becomes the Empire of Israel. The Empire of Israel, in order to restore the Davidic Kingdom, in order to usher in the Messianic Age, they destroy the Dome of the Rock to build the Third Temple. This causes anti-Semitism to explode throughout the world, thus compelling Jews to return to Israel. The entire Islamic world wants vengeance against Israel, but their leadership, their political elite, have been co-opted and compromised by the Anglo-American Empire and by the Israeli Empire. And so this forces revolutions and civil conflict around the Islamic world. And now people are begging for the Mahdi to return. The Mahdi is their world unifier. At this point, there are certain elements within the Islamic world who see Putin as the great savior. And in the Islamic eschatology, the name for Putin is Dao Kanan, which is the same concept as the Orthodox idea of the Catechon, okay? The one who stops the Antichrist from emerging. And so Putin will initiate reconciliation between the Islamic world and the Orthodox world. It will be an alliance between the Orthodox and the Islamic world. And at this point, Putin can now seek reconciliation between the Islamic Empire, the Islamic world and the Israeli Empire. He can also seek reconciliation between the Orthodox world and the Catholic world, and thus unifying the world under him. Okay, so this is the framework of the world for the next 10, 20 years. Now, do I think this will actually happen? Do I actually think that Putin will replace the Anglo-American Empire? He thinks he will succeed, but I don't think he will succeed. And the reason why is because he's human. And once he dies, then civil conflict will arise within this grand alliance. And this civil conflict will lead to catastrophe after catastrophe after catastrophe. It will be the age of tribulation. Many, many people will die in this age of tribulation. So the outlook for humanity is not that great. And this is no different from what happened in about 650, 600 Common Era, when Muhammad was this great charismatic figure who was supposed to unite the entire world. And he would have if he lived another 10 years. Unfortunately, he died. And this created a civil conflict within the Muslim world. Okay, so those are my predictions. Okay, and again, the thesis, the grand idea is eschatology drives geopolitics. So if things happen the way they do, then it's because of eschatology. And that gives us proof, compelling proof, that it's really eschatology that drives geopolitics. So we'll see what happens the next 10, 20 years. Now, having said that all this, I have to say, it's not secret what I'm saying. It's not a great secret I've uncovered. I mean, if you read Alexander Dugin, he lays out this plan coherently in his interviews and in his books. So then the question then is, given that this is public domain knowledge, why doesn't the Anglo-American Empire respond strategically to this? Why doesn't the Anglo-American Empire have countermeasures and counter-strategies? Why isn't the Anglo-American Empire intent on its own self-preservation? And the answer is because the people who control the Anglo-American Empire today don't care. Because they'll be dead in 10, 20, 30 years' time. All they want to do until they die is enjoy their life. And they don't care what will happen to the world after their death. These people, of course, are called the baby boomers. They're the ones who control all the political power, the financial power, the influential power in America, the cultural power in America and in the West today. And that's why the West is dying. Okay? So I'm going to talk about this topic in my next video. So I look forward to seeing everyone then. If you're interested, please join my Discord server. I'm going to put the link below. If you have the means, please support my work by donating to me on Buy Me a Coffee. I really appreciate all the donations. It's real validation of my work. Okay, all right. So thank you so much, and I will see everyone next week.